Sig was named the Orioles Vice President and Assistant General Manager Analytics in November 2018, overseeing all aspects of the club's analytics efforts while contributing to all baseball operations decisions. Mydell is in his 18th season in Major League Baseball and third with the Orioles. Before joining the Orioles, Mydell served as Special Assistant to the General Manager Process Improvement with the Houston Astros. Mydell joined the Astros in 2012 and organized the team's analytics department from its inception during his time there. The Astros were quite successful. They won a World Series championship, made two ALCS appearances, and won two division titles. Prior to joining the Astros, Mydell worked for the St. Louis Cardinals for seven seasons, spending his final season as the team's director, amateur draft analysis. Mydell is a California native, earned bachelor's degrees in mechanical engineering and aeronautical engineering from the University of California, Davis, as well as master's degrees in operations research and cognitive psychology from San Jose State University. Prior to beginning his baseball career, he worked for NASA as a biomathematician. And most important of all, Sig was originally a member of Saber in grade school. So, everyone, please give a warm welcome to Sig Mydell.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, it's working. First of all, welcome. Welcome to Baltimore. If you get a couple blocks over, welcome to beautiful Camden Yards. It's wonderful to have you here, and it is genuinely an honor, fun for me to be here. I have a kinship with you all. You are my people. It was true. Like in fifth grade, I think I was one of the younger ones. I remember going to the conference, having my father, Danish immigrant, drive me, he couldn't care less about baseball, and the poor guy had to sit through the conference. And I remember 2 decades later, he would still tell the family about this one guy who traveled for 2.5 years tracking down Hall of Fame members' graves and taking a picture. And this was his life's calling for 2.5 years, and my dad couldn't believe what he thought was a giant group of nuts. If you're here today, like, forgive the smirk. Arlington Cemetery is nearby. You may love that. I'm definitely going to share a bit of the state of the union with the Orioles and open it up for questions at the end. But I also wanted to first, I think, give attention to a group that's underappreciated, that the work that Mike Elias, our current GM, did, and Jeff Luhnow and myself in St. Louis gets a bit of attention. That's nice. The success at the Astros gets a bit of attention. Of course, the book and the movie Moneyball gets, well-deserved, a ton of attention. But there's one group that I think doesn't quite get enough attention. And I want to, in the spirit of being a good Sabre member, I did a little bit of research that I want to share with you. Maybe I should know better to share it with researchers like this, but I'm going to give it a go anyway. And it's a little bit about the origins of the Moneyball type of change that's going on and still going on in baseball. And sort of this one simple question that I think baseball was waiting to have asked, this one simple idea that changed everything. And so the group that I'm talking about doesn't get enough attention is Sabre's Statistical Analysis Committee. And I'll share a little bit about their role in this revolution, if you will, but also the simple idea, the very important idea that I think changed everything. And that simple idea propagated by Sabre's Statistical Analysis Committee that revolutionized not only the front offices of baseball, but all of baseball. And I don't use the word revolution lightly. It was an upheaval in the status quo. There began to be a feeling that the conventional methods were imperfect, that they could use a bit of improvement. And it did become a battle of, of ideas, and there was a struggle for power. In this case, it was decision-making power within the front offices, and that someone like myself, whose baseball playing career ended in Little League, that someone like myself was actually in a front office was a sign that something really strange was going on. And like any revolution, there's often outsiders trying to change the status quo. And this motley crew, I'm sure you'll recognize, were your founding fathers. Not the most diversified of groups, but looks like there's more diversification in a Mumford and Sons concert, I think, than this group. But as you may know, in 1975, Bill James, along with Pete Palmer, along with Dick Kramer, and others, created the Statistical Analysis Committee. So it was a point where we had outsiders with outsider-like ideas being joined, and that's perhaps like a city. When you combine all sorts of people from different backgrounds with different ideas, you can't help but have the ideas grow. And so this group was prodigious. All sorts of outsider-like ideas grew, and they produced so much. They produced OPS, which we'll see on the scoreboard this afternoon or later in the week if you go to the game, of course. They produced the runs created formula. Range factor was described for the first time in Baseball Digest. Of course, much of my childhood, and I'm sure a lot of your guys' childhood or mature life was spent reading the Bill James baseball abstracts when Palmer and Thorne's Hidden Game of Baseball came out. That was amazing. This group produced Retrosheet, the Bible, Total Baseball, the 90s, looking forward to all the baseball scoreboards. So it was just an amazing amount of production from you guys, from Sabre. But you know what? Like, Major League Baseball really didn't care. There may have been an analyst here and there that came and went, maybe even after a full season, but it was just sort of blips on the radar. There was no lasting change despite these outsiders with these wonderful ideas. Michael Lewis, the writer, of course, of Moneyball, put it well. Here was his quote. He said, "What should have happened didn't happen. What should have happened is this: real as opposed to fantasy general managers would engage with this new growing body of knowledge. The Jamesian movement set the table for the geeks to rush in and take over the general management of the game. Everywhere one turned to in competitive markets, technology was offering the people who understood it an advantage, but not in baseball." And it wasn't because those in charge were unintelligent or unmotivated. They were neither. It was just because they were human beings who have had amazing success to get to where they are with these methods. And those in their social circle were also using these methods. And it was just taken for granted that this was the way you do things. And when you're having success, it's not likely you're going to rethink that. And, like I say, they were human beings, and I think we're a bit of a fickle species when it comes to change. We react somewhere between indifference and pushback, often hostility. And if you're an expert in that field, like, it's extra hard for you to change. And if the change that is being asked of you is counterintuitive, it's going to be extra hard. And if those that are asking you to change are not outside or are outside of your fraternity, they're a type that you haven't worked with before, it's going to be extra, extra hard. So like Michael Lewis, like, of course it was going to be hard to change. But that wouldn't last forever. And so this, many of you may recognize, is Sandy Alderson. So in the 80s, he was working as an attorney in San Francisco, and so he had no desire, no imagination that he was going to be in a baseball front office, much less change forever baseball. And So he was eventually brought in as the general counsel of the Oakland A's, not because he was interested in baseball, but instead because he happened to work with the son-in-law of one of the minority owners, and he's an impressive worker. So he impressed the son-in-law. He let the owner know, we got this smart guy here. He was brought in to the A's as the general counsel. And he must have continued to impress, because the Haas family, who owned the A's at the time, continued to promote him. And their approach was to find smart and creative-minded people, give them plenty of space to try things and to fail. So Sandy Alderson was their smart, creative person. And he must have been really smart and creative, because prior to the 1984 season, he was made general manager of the Oakland A's. So this is incredible. We had an outsider who was now responsible for major league team. And he continued to work in San Francisco while he commuted to Oakland A's as a general manager. And so he would cross the Bay Bridge, and one morning he heard on NPR a Bill James-like researcher named Eric Walker, who was sharing his Bill James-like research. And amazingly, Sandy reached out to him, and amazingly, Sandy began to read Bill James, and more amazingly, he brought these ideas into the front office of the Oakland A's. And this is two decades before Michael Lewis ever met Billy Beane. He would describe it years later as, I had a very limited background in baseball. I'd only been working for the A's for a couple of years and had never been involved in professional baseball before that. I never played baseball. And yet I was in the position where I needed to be able to know how to evaluate players. And so he asked the logical question, how the hell am I going to do this? And so he knew what the A's were doing. He knew he was exposed to conventional methods. But at the same time, he was listening to Eric Walker. He was reading Bill James. He was reading much of the output of Sabre's Statistical Analysis Committee. And he described those things as making perfect sense to him. And that's why he brought it in. And this was, from my little research, like the first time I could find an insider in baseball using outsider information in a lasting way. Like, you could connect the Oakland A's to everything that's going on with baseball today. I know Branch Rickey had an analyst in the 40s, but that sort of came and went. Maybe it's like the Vikings landing on the New World or something. Yeah, they did it, but it's really Columbus, which, you know, good and bad, made all the changes. So, genocide aside, this was the one that changed our world. And I love this sort of research. I found that the very first instance of using this outsider Bill James Sabre-like info was in the 1984 draft, where more athletic, more traditional profiles of players were passed up for the high walk, high homer, less athletic first baseman. And this was Mark McGwire, who turned out to be a good first-round pick. But if you look, this may have been the first fingerprint of outsiders inside of baseball. But if you look at the A's from the late 80s on, their lineups have the fingerprints of the Sabre researchers all over them. There are these high walk, high homer type of players. And from 1984, the time Sandy came in, till the publication of Moneyball, it was only the Yankees had won more games than the A's. And he went on. Sandy said, but anyway, the short answer is it was really the only approach available to me at the time. But it wasn't. He saw how the A's were doing it beforehand. He saw conventional. It was the only approach that passed his level of criticism. It made perfect sense to him, but to the majority of other baseball people, this was not the only approach available. And I think, like, he was asking the right questions, and he had the right idea, and it's that simple idea that I alluded to early, that simple idea that led to the progress in baseball, that led, one could say, to progress everywhere, the simple idea that changes everything. And that idea is to creatively look for explanations of how our world works and then criticize and test those explanations. It's sort of the scientific method. And if you look at the Haas family, as far as creatively looking for explanations, they are hiring creatively minded people. As far as being able to criticize and test, they're all over try and fail and try and fail. And if you look at Sandy's words below there, what am I going to do? Well, I don't know of anything more creative than listening to NPR or reading books from Fandy Cap Knight, Watchmen, you know, Outsiders, than what he was doing. And these were more evidence-based type of methods. And this was the test, the level of criticism that this type of methods had passed. And it made perfect sense to him. And that's what he did. And it made all the difference in baseball. But it also sort of, this might be a little corny, made all the difference for us as a species. I think of like for the thousands of generations of people that came and went, they must have looked up at the sky and seen this star, seen this light, and wondered what that is. What is that made of? What is the relationship between that light and that light? But more importantly, what is the relationship between all these things and us? And every generation came and went, and the individual at the end of their life was no more knowledgeable with these questions than they were at the beginning of their life. It was sort of the same old, generation after generation, until, of course, in the 16th century in the Enlightenment, when there was another revolution, and it was a bit of a revolution against authority. It was against the authority of convention. It was also against the authority of our senses, right? Like, I could see that the world is flat. Look, it's flat. Why? How could it be anything else? Or, yeah, I definitely could see that the sun revolves around the earth. Look. And so it was a rejection of that authority, and then probably of the literal authority of the church. And in replacement of that authority was, or deference to authority, a replacement of that was a criticism, a questioning of how our world works and the hypotheses. And at that time, they had the math, so they could put it through tests and they could actually find answers. And then the world changed. It was a hockey stick of progress. It was not the same old, same old. I think of, in my parents' lifetime, they've seen people go to the moon. They've seen the creation of antibiotics, the splitting of the atom, creation of vaccines, sequencing of DNA, and we've created string theory and string cheese and Velcro and In-N-Out Burger and cell phones. Like, it's nothing like it was back then, and I think it all comes from asking that simple question. And if a person like myself has any use, has any value within baseball, it's just that. There's been so many smart people to come and go in baseball, and what they left behind is what we call convention. And if I have anything to add, it's just that. It's creatively looking for an understanding of how this baseball world works, and then putting it through the rigors of math, whether that's a regression or a retrospective analysis or whatever. And that's all I do, but I don't mean that in any sort of way of minimizing it. That's sort of all you need to do for progress, is to continue to question and test. And the Saber Statistical Analysis Committee is focused on testing existing beliefs. So this is the cause, this is the idea, this is the same thing. Sabermetrics is the search for objective baseball knowledge. This is the cause, this is the idea, it's the same thing. When Sandy Alderson goes, how in the world am I gonna do this? And then looks at Saber-inspired outsiders, it's the same cause. And I think that's why I especially feel this kinship with the research you guys are doing. It's all the same thing. It's all the same cause. And you know the story from here, that Sandy Alderson hired an ex-player, Billy Beane, exposed him to these ideas. Kudos to him. He gravitated towards them. He became general manager. He hired an economist from Harvard, Paul DePodesta, and they brought in, for some reason, a best-selling author, and they pulled back the curtain. And surprise, surprise, this best-selling author wrote a best-selling book about their processes. And that book, of course, jump-started this change that was already taking place but hadn't really exploded yet. It changed my life. I remember when I read that, I read it in one sitting with a poor night's sleep in between. And I thought that, I was so naive. I thought, oh, I just need to let the teams know that I'm here. I'm available. I'm willing to relocate. You know, I get along well with people. And I'll have a job by the end of the week. But I couldn't have been more wrong. It's a story in itself, but after about a year and a half of efforts to get in, it amazingly lined up with me at the St. Louis Cardinals. So at that time, the owner, Bill DeWitt, who had also read Moneyball, had brought in another outsider, Jeff Luno, and made him scouting director, which in and of itself is incendiary, that there's scouts working their whole lives for this position. And I'm going to take, Jeff was working with the son-in-law of the owner. So once again, I think if you want to get into baseball, perhaps find out where the son-in-law of the owner works, get a job there, and befriend him. And so anyway, Jeff was in, and they hired myself. And what was great about it is I was, I believe, the fourth analyst in baseball. So 26 of the 30 teams thought the perfect number of analysts to have was zero. It's not too many, not too few. Zero was perfect. And so the good about that was if there was any innovation, any sort of learning about how this baseball world works that was a little unconventional, we would enjoy the innovation pretty much all for ourselves. It was like being at a buffet table and it was just you. And so we did find some inefficiencies, and we did take advantage of them in the 7 years we were with St. Louis, and we had good success with that. At the end of the 2011 season, we had won the World Series with a good amount of homegrown players, so that was rewarding. But an opportunity came to go to Houston, and so Houston was last place in many ways at the time. Their farm system was the lowest ranked. Their major league team was losing more than any other team. And one interesting thing, one week they had TV ratings of 0.0. So that means that of the nearly 1,000 Nielsen set-top monitors, nobody was watching the Astros. And so there was no evidence anybody in the city was watching the Astros. But it was still going to be an exciting opportunity because we imagined doing what we had done in the draft, but having it permeate the entire system. And so I went along with our current GM, Mike Elias. We went to Houston, and we did. These ideas did permeate the entire system. Baseball started hiring analysts at this nonlinear rate, and so much of the advantage of the draft, the buffet table, was now shoulder to shoulder with other people trying to get at your cheese toast. And so it was a different world, but about that time there was some technology, radar technology advances with pitch tracking and such, and we were able to take advantage of that, and we had success in Houston also. And then after the 2018 season, we had the best run differential in baseball, but we lost to the darn Red Sox in the ALCS. The year before we had won the World Series, but an opportunity came up in Baltimore. And again, we had the number one farm system, so things were looking good in Houston. And Baltimore, like, it's well documented. It was pretty grim. that was pretty grim. So they were the worst team in baseball, but not just the worst team in baseball. They were the worst team by 10 games. So thankfully, there's no relegation in our country because there might have been a leading candidate there. When they played a team with a losing record, they lost two-thirds of the game. So it was really, they were sort of in a league of their own at that time. But that wasn't it. That wasn't all. They also had the lowest or one of the worst ranked farm systems, so there wasn't really help on the way. That wasn't all either. 30% of the talent comes internationally, most from the Dominican, as you know. And the Orioles were opting not to sign international players. And so they were playing with this giant self-imposed handicap. And that wasn't all. their highest paid players were, to put it nicely, not productive. And there were still 8 years and about $150 million of salary owed, promised. To them. And so for a team that's not in a giant market, that's sort of crippling. And that's not all. So while baseball had about 400 analysts at the time, the Orioles had zero, but one skilled developer who wasn't really appreciated. So they were using the best practices of the 80s at that time. But that wasn't all. We're in the American League East, where look at the teams. Every team is rich, smart, super smart, some combination of that. It's got to be the most difficult division in all of sports. But that wasn't all. You know what? No, that was all. but it was still a surprisingly attractive decision to come here. And one thing I had learned from my experiences in St. Louis and Houston was that it's impossible to make any sort of meaningful change without the support of the ownership, the GM, and everyone on down. You can't get a nice, friendly person to share ideas with this really experienced person who has no motivation to change and expect real change. You need a clear message. And I was fortunate enough to work with these two owners, Bill DeWitt and Jim Crane in St. Louis and Houston. And here's quotes from them. Like, what sort of owner talks this way? You know, I could see the landscape changing. Processes weren't sound. We need better info to run them ragged. You know, it was easy to be critical, but I'm willing to put up with the scrutiny and the disruption. So I can't accomplish anything in baseball, no matter how polite I am or how convincing the data is, without ownership support and the GM support throughout. And in the interview process with Baltimore, it was clear that John Angelos was like-minded. He had come in the middle of 2018 and overhauled the business side. He had hired Mike Elias and myself from Houston for the baseball side in late 2018 and really just committed to modernization. So the first thing we did is to change the analytics department from zero. We're about a dozen now, with six really skilled interns and openings for three more. So we're growing as fast as we can. There's still many teams that have more, but in my experience, like, getting the right person is more important than getting a number of people. So we're doing well, very well, I'd say. And although the fans can't see it, the decision-making processes within the Orioles are completely different. And they're as sound, as modern as anything I've seen. And that's really all we could do. The results come from your processes and then this roll of the dice. But I know our processes are sound. As far as that 30% handicap, we've built a facility in the Dominican. We're signing Dominican players. We already have a foreign player in high A, a Dominican in low A. So help is on the way from the Dominican. And that's not really what our facility looks like. It's this right now. But it's coming. It's coming, as are the players. And more locally, like, we've been doing the same thing. We've really beefed up the infrastructure in the U.S. With improved facilities. We have almost all new coaches, and they're modern coaches who are aware of the more modern techniques, and yeah, they could handle modern tech too. Pitching labs to really bear down on the biomechanics of the pitchers. We've built one nearby, and it's all in order to develop our hitters and our pitchers as well, or better than anybody. And yeah, there's a lot of tech. We have the radar devices, player tracking, bat sensors, high-speed video, ball tracking, and body sensors. So all things that they simply weren't taking advantage of 5 years ago. So we're in there. We have our one-stop shopping for all things Orioles, our dashboard. It's called OMAR for Orioles Management and Research, but it's really an homage to the wonderful Wire character, Omar. It's the one that was, yeah, I agree, robbing drug dealers but never pointed a gun at a civilian. So that's our data system. And we've already seen some improved results. What was one of the most challenging player development systems is now ranked number one by most of the third-party publications. And you'll see if you go to the game this afternoon or later this week, the first player we took in the 2019 draft, Adley Rutschman, has progressed just fine. You'll see him playing there. And we got there's help on the way. We got a couple strong pitchers, D.L. Hall, Grayson Rodriguez, who will be up as soon as possible. Gunnar Henderson was the second player we drafted. He's now that Adley's in the majors, he's now the number one prospect in the entire country. So that is wonderful. And we have Colton Cowser, Westberg, Mayo, players that likely we'll see in the future. And this doesn't count Jackson Holliday that we drafted last month, 1-1. So there's help. The coaches are modern. You know, I don't know what other teams are doing. We try to find out, but I could see what we're doing, and it's sound. As far as the Major League team, it's a lot of fun this year. We surpassed our 2021 win total in July. there's no quit in these players. The staff is amazing. It's the truth. Like, it's fun to watch them. It doesn't take but a game before you realize that how these guys are enjoying the game is unusual. The celebrations they have in the dugout, the smiles on their faces, it's hard not to enjoy watching it. It's just fun. But what's also special is the fans, and I didn't appreciate that till I came here. I didn't know much about Baltimore till I came here. But the importance and reverence the fans have to baseball, to their baseball players, and to the stadium is really special. Like, Baltimore loves their Orioles. That is so very clear. And so I know when you go to the game, you're going to see the beauty of this 30-year-old ballpark. I hope you're going to see the excitement that the players have, but I also hope you end up seeing the importance that this team is to the people of Baltimore. And it's been a privilege to be a part, like, they deserve the best. And it's been a privilege to be a part of the group that is trying their hardest to give them the best. And I know I'm lucky to be here, and I know I wouldn't be here without Sabre. It's the truth. And I mentioned Pete Palmer and Bill James, and also Dick Kramer. There's rumors that Dick may be in attendance. Is that true? There. Yeah. And so I want to thank Dick, all the founding fathers, all of Sabre, for sort of creating this world with this amazing timing that's enabled this change in baseball. And for me to just happen to be in the middle of it, coming in at the right time, it's meant the world. So thank you again. That's all I have. I think we have a good amount of time for questions, and I will answer everything that I can while pretending Yankees plants are throughout the room. Yes.
Hi there. I guess in your role as front office of a Major League Baseball team, baseball is a game played by humans. You have expected outcomes, but you have unexpected outcomes. How do you, in your role, in your team, handle and deal with those unexpected outcomes and manage those? How does that concept of the game play into your thinking?
Yeah, so we're stuck being human beings. And so I didn't handle them very well at first. Like, if this was supposed to work and this guy had a better chance, and if it didn't turn out that way, there was like this frustration of why is the world conspiring against me and my plan. But I think over time, you just take it in stride and you put a smirk or shake your head. Like, we've had some pretty crazy things. Remember that 2011 World Series in St. Louis? Like, we were down to our last strike. Like, it was over, and the baseball gods shone on us that day. And so I think we got a lot of credit for when things go wrong. We've had 1-1 picks that never produced anything for us. We've had all sorts of bad luck and good luck, and I think you just sort of get immune to it and remind yourself that maybe you did do a right decision and you had a bad result. If you had that bad luck or bad result, it maybe throttles up the insecurity you have on whether this process is right. But I lose much less stomach lining now than I did in the early days when things don't go well. Yes, sir.
Thank you, and congratulations on a wonderful season that you're having here. I'm from Minneapolis and usually follow the Twins, and I found myself streaming a lot of Oreo games.
Oh, good. Keep that up.
6 weeks or so here. But my question is, we all know that one of the themes in Moneyball was the tension between old line scouts and new analytics people. I'm curious if you have any good stories regarding that tension with scouting departments and some of the old-timers.
Yeah, and it's true. I think I came with a crazy bias. My world was academia and then NASA Ames research. And so data-driven and evidence-based decision-making is just like the air you breathe. And so I naively came into baseball thinking, okay, like, what these scouts need is a scatter plot with some p-values, and all's going to be well. And it was like that. I quickly learned that's not how the real world works. And so I think when I look at how I've changed, it's a realization on how you communicate these type of things to the real world or to anybody other than a NASA engineer. And so there's a lot of techniques that work to different degrees. There's a whole field of change management. There's worlds of motivational interviewing, of how you could get a human being who is naturally going to be against this to be a little bit open to it, and then over time maybe plant a seed that grows. As far as instances, yeah, there's times I've braced myself for a punch when a scout was saying it's not this frickin' shit, it's tools that get you to the majors. And I remember like saying that's not what the data says, you know, in a nice way, and bracing myself for what was next. But no, I mean, if you've met a scout, they're the most lovable person ever. I think they're inspired that they have a job that enables them to be in the game. And the portrayal in Moneyball has not been my experience. They're for the most part open-minded and interested and excited to get better.
Thank you.
Yes.
Part of your career path that got me fascinated in what you did was a book called Fantasyland.
Fantasyland, yeah.
And I'm wondering how that fit into your development and getting into baseball. If you could explain working for Sam Walker, how that was.
Yeah, so I alluded to the difficulty of getting in baseball. So I was attending the winter meetings. Attending is a nice word. I was not invited, but I showed up, and I was loitering in the lobby for 3 days waiting for an important-looking person to walk from the elevator to the front door so I could describe how they needed to create this position and then hire me. So it was a lot of loitering, and during that time, I met Sam Walker. He was writing this book, going to write this book about fantasy baseball. I didn't care, but I thought, okay, this is another good excuse to not pick up more real work. I'll be working for, like, nothing for the book. So it was a great experience. At that time, though, front offices couldn't care less about fantasy baseball. They weren't looking at, like, oh, this guy was an analyst in fantasy baseball. This is exactly what we need to get into the front office. In fact, I think it would have been a deterrent. So it had absolutely nothing to do with it, but it created a good friendship with Sam and Nando, who I still see.
Yes. Oh, thanks. That was wonderful, by the way. Thank you.
Sure.
Second, I would like to know what you think from the last decade or so of the best development. I'm a big fan of Voros McCracken.
Yeah.
And Dips, and if that's one of and the second part of my question is, where does your son-in-law work?
Yeah. Now you got to get the owner, like, it's a little twist there. Now, not me, it's the owner's son-in-law. I don't know, he's a young man, and maybe he's going to end up with us here, who knows. So what was the question, the last 10 years in the Voris McCracken research?
How important is Dips to you?
Yeah, I think, like, Dips was crazy important because the intuition of this ERA and a pitcher getting shelled was so clearly the pitcher's fault and responsibility, and it helped us divorce ourselves from what is overwhelmingly most entirely luck to the underlying skill. So I think all the teams appreciate that now. Whatever the projection system is, it's sort of throwing everything into the mix and seeing what predicts next year. And so those doubles you gave up, those homers you gave up, those singles have a surprisingly low voice in that. So while I don't think Dips itself is specifically mentioned, but the findings of Dips and how counterintuitive it is has got to be mentioned. And it's still a struggle. Like, now this guy's ERA is terrible. Look what he's done. But, like, now it's just been a whole lot of bad luck, and his homer per fly ball ratio is okay. So those still go on. So I think Voris would be happy if he was in any of those meetings.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. So I think it's been pretty well accepted that the analytics battle has been fought and won by the geeks, thankfully, and that there are just a last couple few organizations that are getting dragged kicking and screaming in the 21st century. I won't name any names, but this will probably give you a clue. So, you know, and I think that even as you go into areas like biomechanics and the understanding of things along those are related to analytics, and there's not really anybody fighting that I know of. But can you think of any other innovative area that might engender the same kind of opposition that analytics did at its very beginning among organizations?
That's a good question. I think if we include biomechanics in analytics, we're sort of making the assumption that these biomechanics or even like these counting stats, that when you put somebody with a quantitative background, he or she's going to squeeze something useful out of it. Mm-hmm. While the prior method relied on simply experts and their senses. I see this, I know this, their mental math and their experience and the mental models they've created. And so I think that's what you do when you have nothing else. And baseball held off the nothing else, you know, the everything else for quite a while. But I can't think of anything that could change things as much as the idea of let's use all the information we have and let's combine it in the proper way.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the mental models have been kind of cast aside and for the analytics, and like everything that's coming up next is kind of analytics-based, do you think? And kind of as an offshoot of that?
Yeah, well, the scouts are experts. They're experts at the hitting swing, at the defense, and so my argument has always been, like, let's quantify it and let's throw it into the mix and let's let real life and real players in real baseball let us know the weight of it. And if the weight should be zero, then it's zero. If the weight should be 92%, then that's it. And we're not we still have a full load of scouts, and this is after 18 years, so that hints that even after we've squeezed all we can out of the numbers and the biomechanics and the high-speed video, what these expert pattern recognition humans are able to provide has predictive power, and we don't want to go to this fight with one arm tied behind our back. So while you put it, it's one, I guess so. I guess analytics have come into the decision-making pie, and analysts have helped determine the weight of these things, and some of their decision-making pie has, for good reason, has been shared now, but they're still there and they're still valuable.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, sir.
I have two questions, but the first one's flat out yes or no. Are you encountering other people working for Major League Baseball teams with experience in tabletop or laptop fantasy baseball?
Yes.
To what extent? Okay.
Feel like I'm on the stand
the
here.
Organizations for which you've worked employ simulations similar to fantasy baseball in trying to evaluate players to be acquired or traded away or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say if you evaluate a player with all the information available, you could describe as best as human beings can this player's expectation on the bases defensively and hitting next year and 2 years and 3 years and 4 years and 5 years from now. And if you have that, it might make it to the top of your list of let's simulate our organization for the next 5 years and let's value players like that. If you have a manager and there's a question of whether you should walk a Rosarena in the third inning, well, let's look at the numbers and let's simulate a million games with that walk, a million games without the walk, and look at the numbers and see what we might be missing. So keep it just between us. Yeah, I think that's going on. Yes.
Earlier this season, there was a pitching coach, Wes Johnson, with the Minnesota Twins, who left to go to college ball with what was called a substantial increase in salary.
Yeah.
At some point, do you see a change in how the coaches will be hired, maybe along the lines of what the NFL is doing, hiring college coaches to go at the big league level, especially with the emphasis that will be more on college ball with changes in draft and stuff like that? Because it was hard to believe that a coach wasn't compensated accordingly to his expertise and would choose to go to college ball instead of Major League Baseball. Not that money is lacking MLB, as far as I know.
Yeah, I think the answer to so much is yes, but surprisingly slowly, that baseball, in my opinion, sort of had this culture, a coach, let's just get an ex-player, we'll make him a coach, and we'll assume that since he was a good player, he's a good coach. And there wasn't this realization that these skills might not completely overlap and that the skills of a coach are actually skills and you could develop them. So I think there was, in general, little appreciation of that. The pay for coaches was poor. It's slowly changing. Some are coming from college to major leagues, and some are going to large college large schools with good college baseball teams. And so we're getting better, but the pay in college, I think with all the redefinition of what's an amateur and the sharing of the money, the expansion of the staff, that's going up too. And I don't know where it will end, but there's a lot of people understandably so that have family and are pro food and shelter, and if there's more money over there, we lose them. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm a big fan of the other black and orange team,
yeah,
as you can see. And two words, Mike Yastrzemski. How did that happen?
Next. Yeah, I think it's a reminder that we're imperfect. So Mike Yastrzemski was a player we didn't put on our 40-man roster. The Giants took him, and we would like to go back in time and put him on our 40-man roster. Yeah, he's happy orange and black. No, I think it's in retrospect, it was a bad result. One could argue whether it was a bad decision given what we knew at the time, but there definitely is a regret there, and there definitely have been conversations of what if anything did we miss. So we wish him well, but there's a part where it's a little hard to see. But thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Bringing that up.
One of the things we've seen with teams is they're rebuilding, and I think the Orioles are probably a little surprised to be doing as well as they are this year, is prospects being called up perhaps later than they can be helpful during the season in which they're playing. And I want to know, but teams also gaining a year of control out of that. So how do you balance like the need of the franchise with what I assume is like the frustrations of the player who feels like they're ready and the frustration of fans who are really eager to see somebody like Grayson Rodriguez or a Gunnar Henderson?
Yeah. So first of all, like the mindset of a player, I'll tell you one quick story. So we often will interview players at a workout before they're drafted. And one of the questions we ask is, what do you have to work on to get to be in the major leagues? And they'll often say nothing, that they're ready. They just need to like get used to playing in front of 30,000 fans.
That's also my answer for me. Yeah.
So I've yet to meet a player that is too conservative with when he thinks he's ready for the major leagues. We want to win as quickly as possible, and that's as important to us as anybody, and we have a lot of our math, our energies have been dedicated to figuring out this transition from AAA to the majors is the largest that they're going to make, and it does us no good to bring the guy up to have him fail. Like, it's real up here, and so that's tremendously costly. So we have a lot of numbers and subjective evaluations quantified that give us an idea of whether this player is going to be successful up here. And the players don't know that, the writers don't know that, and sometimes, you know, a 900 OPS in AAA doesn't speak to that completely. So the service time is insignificant compared to the leverage of a playoff chance and the reward that the fans get and the team gets when you're in the playoffs. So we're balancing it. We're leveraged this year. We have estimations of our leverage in the future. And some of these players that seem like they're ready, they're not as ready as sometimes as the writers are writing about, given all the info we have. So my answer, and maybe it'll be met with skepticism, is as quickly as possible we bring them up.
And in terms of communication with them on that process, like how closely do you communicate about, you know, what their timeline is and what they need to work on and that kind of thing?
Yeah, and so they have very specific player development plans, but there's not like, okay, when you have all these boxes checked, voila, you come into the major leagues. That's so much depends on what we have in the major leagues. And when you go to the major leagues, somebody is getting released or getting sent down. And so it depends on a whole lot of moving parts. And, yeah, our AAA coaches probably put up with WTF, you know. And I'm not exactly the psychology they use, but I would hope the players know we're all in this together and we're joined at the hips as far as wanting the best players to be in the major leagues.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hey, good to see you.
All right, I'm a Yankees fan, so, you know, but that's okay, that's all right. So we know baseball is approaching this crossroads with the casual fan who's just going to a game just for a couple of beers, and then the hyper fan who knows all the stats, knows all the data, like many of the people here today. So my question is more on the business side, what are some of the trends that you're noticing, first of all, and second, where do you see the business side of baseball going in the future?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think baseball has had the culture that I described with the coaches, like it was just low pay, you would get people that were just motivated to work in baseball and regardless of their skills or what their skills could demand in other industries, they would be in baseball for, you know, minimal payroll. So that's changing. Like so many things, it's slowly changing. Business sides, I see the analytics. We really saw it in Houston grow. So a lot with the ticketing analytics and all the strategizing of that. I see the business side just sort of becoming a more modern, well-paid entity, just like so many other industries. And this idea of let's get passionate people who will work for a decade with no pay raise, and we still think we're going to have the best we could possibly have. I see that thinking going away, but perhaps at a slower pace than one might imagine. Okay.
Not to put you on the spot.
Sorry.
Not to put you on the spot, but I love this new team, you know, developing these new players. But is there any hope that in the future the owner's not going to repeat history and trade these players away, you know, after they're developed?
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing that's not going to change anytime soon is, as we're not in the market of New York, we're not in the market of Boston, that a win to us doesn't return the financial gains a win to the Yankees and their YES Network do. And so I feel confident we're gonna spend as much as we can as efficiently as we can, but sometimes it doesn't make sense to outbid the richest teams in baseball who get this outsized reward for the players, and instead we have to look for more efficient ways to beat them. And I know we're gonna be looking at them, and there's ways of winning. I mean, look at Tampa Bay's won the East the last 2 years. So there's ways of winning without simply outbidding the Yankees and the Red Sox on the highest priced free agent. So I think we're gonna occasionally lose a loved player here and there, but I think in the big picture, it's going to be beneficial and it's going to increase the playoff runs and the excitement our fans had. Like I think of St. Louis, we lost Albert Pujols. If there was ever a more heart-wrenching situation in baseball, I don't know what that is. But you know what? Like the Cardinals were just fine because of it. And I don't know if outbidding a bigger market team would have been the right thing in the long run for them. Thank you very much.